This programme is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, engaging minds created in the image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. What is the best explanation for relationships? This is part one of this series on abductive reasoning. And Ken, you're going to help us to understand concepts about love, and we're going to be talking about God's love in particular. In fact, we're recording this podcast on Valentine's
Day.
That's
right.
Thank you for the flowers, by the way.
Well, you're very welcome.
Dave, thank you for the chocolate.
Oh, really?
Even though he ate some of it, right? Well, I thought that this would be a good opportunity on Valentine's Day. Of course, our listeners will be hearing this a little later.
A few weeks later.
It takes a couple weeks to get through the system. But I do want to talk about love. I want to talk about relationships. I want to talk about the value that we place upon people. And the context of that will be what I call best explanation apologetics. And I'm going to unpackage that for everybody. Well, many people have heard me who have listened to Straight Thinking or Imago Dei or both.
Right.
You've heard me talk about this abductive reasoning, and in logic, to kind of speak simply and directly, there are kind of three ways of reasoning. You can construct your argument in a deductive manner, and if you do that well enough, if your premises that provide the support of the argument are tightly constructed to the conclusion, what you end up with is a certain conclusion. So if all men are mortal, and Socrates is one of those men who's mortal, then we know with certainty he's mortal. We also have, however, what we call inductive reasoning that rides on probability. The best my conclusion can be proved to is a degree of probability. And that, in many ways, is kind of the driving argument behind science. It's not that scientists don't engage in deduction, they do, but science often is about probabilities and testing those relationships. But there's a third form of reasoning that's less well known, and it is involved in science, and it's called abductive reasoning. Not abduction where the spaceship takes you away, but abductive reasoning, where instead of looking at probabilities or certainty, you are looking at what is the best explanation for a phenomena. And so instead of probability, certainty, you might talk about plausibility. And abductive reasoning is similar to induction in that it doesn't carry certainty, but it is different from induction in that it's not attempting to predict something. And I think that predictive ability is a big part of science. But scientists use abductive reasoning oftentimes when they're trying to develop an initial hypothesis. So abductive reasoning is very common. The illustration or the example that I like to appeal to, and it's Tuesday today, so at my house on the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month, the street sweeper comes, right? So I have to keep my car on the driveway or I'll get a ticket. But here's my analogy or my illustration. Suppose you're sleeping in on a Saturday, kind of a sleepy Saturday morning, and you finally kind of are coming to your awake state, right? Sleep is kind of foggy where there are times where you're not quite asleep, but you're not awake. You're kind of in that middle ground, so you're kind of groggy, and you kind of open your eyes and you peek through the blinds and you see that the street is wet. What's your immediate inference? What explanation do you draw almost immediately and intuitively?
It's raining.
It must have rained. And yeah. We actually now have some rain in Southern California.
Yeah, plenty of it.
So we have that experience.
We now have that experience. Now, of course, the exception is I know that the street sweeper comes the second and fourth Tuesday, so that can be an alternative explanation. But the idea here is that it seems that human beings are constructed in a way that we look at something and we intuitively and immediately seek to understand by asking, how can this best be explained? So that's that abductive approach. Mm-hmm. Now, there are logicians. At Biola University, I teach a course in logic, and I use Patrick Hurley's textbook, A Concise Introduction to Logic. And Hurley would say, for example, that this kind of abductive reasoning is kind of the natural way that human beings think, that we kind of intuitively are searching for explanations. Now, I think that this is a natural to apply to Christian apologetics.
I think I've heard you say that physicians and mechanics employ this as well as a diagnostic tool. You go see the doctor, he begins to ask questions to try to diagnose your illness.
Yes.
He may send you off for a test or two, but he or she might ask you some questions to diagnose your illness. Same with the auto mechanic, right?
That's exactly right. And that's the key word, diagnosis, diagnostic. Hmm. Anybody who works in the field of trying to explain this, coming to a diagnostic point of view. Exactly right, Joe. Detectives, you know, they look at evidence and they try to then explain a theory that accounts for the evidence. Historians look at facts and events and they come up with explanations. You can think of a scientist moving from data to a hypothesis. Maybe the best example is the physician, where you go in and you say, you know, here, what's troubling you? And you give them your symptoms, and it may involve some type of evaluation or tests, but there is a diagnosis of what the problem is. And in medicine, of course, they can't treat you until they come up with some kind of diagnosis. They may hurt you if they don't know a reliable diagnosis. And so a doctor, as he is kind of looking at, you know, Dave's got the sinus issues, Dave's got pain here or there, what is the diagnosis that would account for those kinds of mm-hmm. things? And then, of course, I often bring up my dad, who in his early life was a coal miner, but after the war, my family moved to California, and my dad became a truck and car mechanic. He worked for a while at Knudsen. The ice cream company there in Los Angeles had those big trucks and everything. But my dad, who was a very kind-hearted individual, thought that Christians should be showing their charity toward people. I noticed when I was a young boy, my dad would actually tune up the cars for a number of the widows that lived in the neighborhood. And I didn't quite understand, why are these old ladies coming up, pulling their car in my dad's driveway? Mm. But my dad recognized that probably the husband was the one who cared for the automobile. So my dad would have him pull up the car, open up the hood, and he'd listen to the engine. Of course, I was a young boy then. I didn't realize my dad had spent a lot of time, you know, working on the internal combustion engine and looking at cause-effect relationships. I thought it was magical. Mm. You know, the idea that my dad could actually listen to an engine and then tell you what was wrong with it, you know, that's a carburetor problem or some other problem. I thought, man, my dad is like a shaman, you know. Who other kids in the neighborhood have a dad who can just listen and tell you? Mm. Well, what I learned later, talking with my dad and actually going to some of the conventions that he went to, because I always wanted to hang around with my dad, and I'm going to come back to that because we want to talk about relationships. But I began to see that my dad was a diagnostician, and in the company in which he worked, the garage, when they had a difficult engine, they'd call my dad in. And he would kind of diagnose what, ooh, this is a problem. And sometimes engines can be tricky. You know, they don't know quite what it is. There's nothing more frustrating than to have a car problem that you can't resolve or it keeps lingering. Well, my dad was a diagnostician when it came to engines. What I want to say is, what if we did our apologetics where we were diagnosticians? What is the best explanation for the most meaningful realities of life? I mean, at Reasons to Believe, we talk a lot about mind and rationality and logic. You know, we talk a lot about human intelligibility. We also talk about values and morality and beauty. I think there is a very powerful way of reasoning toward Christianity where we illustrate that the most meaningful realities of life, and again, here I'm appealing to things like the universe, its beginning, its complexity. I'm talking about ethics. I'm talking about human beings, the fact that they exist, they're conscious beings, they're capable of rationality, or our religious phenomena that, you know, we desire to have a relationship with God, that the best explanation for these profound realities is God, that they point to God. Now remember, go ahead, Dave.
Well, I just have a question here. When you're looking at some phenomena and you now have a collection of possible explanations, the assumption here, if you're going to use those to try and explain this phenomena, is that that collection is somehow complete or at least contains in it an explanation.
Yeah.
There's an assumption here that you have, in your experience, enough information to be able to come up with an explanation.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, we know, for instance, if someone is trying to explain, say, the beginning of the universe.
Right.
And they were, you know, it was done 500 years ago. Well, they didn't have nearly enough information to be able to come up with an explanation.
A scientific explanation.
A scientific explanation.
Yeah.
It would have to be limited to... Yeah. Well, God did it, or, you know, something of that nature. So how do you adjust for that, or how do you...
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that what we discover 500 years ago, Dave, is that you have philosophical and theological explanations for the nature of the universe. I mean, in philosophy, we would ask the question, we have a universe out here. We don't see any reason to conclude that it's eternal. Therefore, we draw a conclusion that it needs some kind of explanation for its existence. Now, that's kind of purely a philosophical explanation. We could also bring in the theology and say, we have this revelation from God, and God has revealed to us that He created this universe. So we're being informed by our theology and our philosophy. Now, what would be very helpful as we move ahead into the future would be some instruments that could help us to take it further and say, now we seem to have some data, not only from math, but from observation, that would indicate that the universe had a beginning. And in some sense, I think that even scientific analysis is still dependent upon deeper issues of mathematics and even philosophy. We are talking about cause and effect. I mean, the scientist's assumption is, I can trust my eyes and my five senses. Mm-hmm. My cognitive faculty and sensory organs operate properly. There is a real world out there. I can trust logic and math. So even the scientist is appealing to kind of these fundamental philosophical and I would even say theological principles. Mm-hmm. So, but your point is well taken. We now have some instruments that seem well suited to try to provide explanation. Although, as you and Jeff and Hugh often bring up, there are immediately people that begin to say, well, it may not be as simple as you think it is. There may be these other explanations of multiverse and all of these right. kinds of explanations.
Well, and the thing is, too, is that often the unbeliever, the naturalist, is objecting to our theological explanations. They are, of course, looking for naturalistic explanations.
That's right.
So their bag of tricks, as you might say.
Or their assumptions they're bringing to the table.
Are naturalistic.
Sure.
And then they argue that the history of theological explanations have demonstrated, at least to some degree, that often they're wrong, and that we come along with a naturalistic explanation that earlier people, religious people, gave a theological explanation for. So there's a degree of care that has to be taken that you're not...
Absolutely. Now let me throw a challenge to that idea, though, Dave. I think that when we ask these deep questions, like where did the universe come from?
For instance.
Or how did life begin? Or how do we explain consciousness? You know, these big issues, the origin of life, the origin of humanity, the origin of consciousness, you know, these are these profound issues that we struggle with. But remember that when it comes to explanation, what are the preconditions for explaining things? Well, I think clearly the preconditions for explaining things is that we can trust our minds, that math and logic are reliable sources of information, that we are encountering a real world out there. It seems to me that maybe the better question, Dave, than, well, you know, the theologians and philosophers speculate about the origin of the universe, but the scientists kind of come and explain things. Well, I think there's a deeper question. Why should you trust mathematics? Why should you trust logic? Mm-hmm. Why should you be able to trust consciousness? That is the very things. Why does nature operate in a reliable and trustworthy manner? It seems like the explanation is not directly observation. It is things like relying upon logic, math, and these intuitive types of principles. And I would say, maybe to the Lawrence Krausses of the world or the Michael Shermers or, you know, some of the others, I would say, what best explains those realities? Are they just brute realities? Or does logic and mathematics and intuition and consciousness, maybe they're better explained by God? So I think sometimes we have to kind of challenge the very level of explanation. And so we try to explain the universe by appealing to math, by appealing to logic, by appealing to observation. Well, where do those things come from?
Of course, they would like to argue that they'll eventually come up with a naturalistic explanation.
They have a lot of faith.
They
have faith in the future, but scientists aren't supposed to operate by faith. They're supposed to operate by reason. It's the fallacy of the appeal to the future. Trust me, because I'll come up with an answer in the future.
Well, and they base that on the fact that science has been pretty successful in the past. In other words, there is a record of successes that give them some faith or whatever you want to call it, confidence.
Granted.
That,
but it was a theological, philosophical system that birthed science.
Yeah.
So sometimes I think, Dave, there's kind of, you know, philosophy and theology kind of got science rolling, and I think people now want to hitch a ride to science without giving any credit to the systems of thought that gave the foundation to it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take that and what's very appropriate, Dave, about your comment is we have to have some ability to adjudicate. How do we judge something as being the best explanation, right? That I think, is a very fair question. I would offer a couple things. I would say that the best explanation has some balance between complexity and simplicity. And what I mean by that is the best explanation is the simplest one, but is fully orbed, that really does explain the system.
Has sufficient complexity.
That's right.
To fill out.
It can explain the data in the simplest way.
Right.
So it's more than Occam's razor. It mm-hmm. has to be a fully orbed explanation. A second question that we would appropriately ask is it a coherent idea? You know, is it reasonable? Is it rational? Does it hold together? We might ask, how well does it match the facts? Does it explain, you know, the data? And we want to be careful about assumptions and ad hoc explanations, right? Just inventing an explanation out of thin air to try to explain some data. I think those are the kinds of things. And is it fruitful? Does it seem to provide some sense of explanation? Now, in light of all of that kind of laying the logical groundwork, if you will, I want to develop something a little deeper here. And I want to ask, on Valentine's Day, why are relationships so very important to us? I was listening to a talk that the Christian philosopher Greg Gansel, his name is spelled Gansselle. He was at Yale for a number of years and is now over at Biola University, teaches at Talbot. I like him. He's a very sharp guy, and I think he gravitates toward kind of a best explanation, right? His talk on YouTube was entitled Why Christianity Makes Sense, right? Makes mm-hmm. sense. Well, Gansel, I thought, had a very provocative point. He was mentioning 9/11, and he said that on 9/11, 2001, of course, this terrible terrorist attack that took place here in America, about 3,000 people were killed in the attack. The events were so horrific. Sometimes I search my mind, did that really happen? I mean, it was such an amazing thing that jumbo jets would actually crash into the Twin Towers. And these incredible buildings there in New York City, and I remember being in New York and seeing them before 9/11, and I've been back to New York afterwards and seen the rebuilding and the memorial mm-hmm. to the 9/11 victims. But, you know, these buildings are so tall, but to see them actually collapse, and then the untold number of people who were trapped in these buildings, who worked there, adding to that the firemen and policemen who went rushing into mm-hmm. a building. I've always found it amazing. I have a friend, Mark Perez. Joe and Dave, you know him. He's a visiting scholar here. He had a long career with the Los Angeles Police Department. And, you know, I've talked to Mark, and we've talked a little bit about courage. And I remember one day him telling me that, you know, there were times where you got to go into a dark building, and the guy in that building may have a gun, and mm-hmm. It's your job to go in there. Well, you know, my tendency would be to want to go out, not to run in. Mm-hmm. But you have these firemen, courageous firemen, policemen that go rushing into these buildings, and then they collapse. Greg Gansel says this. He asks this point. He makes this point. He said nobody on 9/11 was asking about the physical structure of the building. That is, isn't it terrible that these buildings fell down? They were asking about the people, right? Nobody called and said, "Wow, we didn't get any work done today." No, the focus was on the people, the individual lives. Flight 93, right, that was hijacked and apparently was intended to fly it into Washington, maybe hit the Capitol building or the White House, right? You know, the terrorists were sending a message. They hit the Pentagon, right? And that's the American military. And they hit the Twin Towers. That's the American Financial District. And then apparently the intention was to strike at the government, to hit, you know, the Capitol building, or to strike the White House. A diabolical kind of attack. And we're talking 3,000 people, so we're talking more people were killed on 9/11 than were killed the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So this was an event, and Ganzel says, but what we focus upon is the people, the relationships. Mm-hmm. And I want to delve into that a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about relationships. You know, I was thinking last night about this issue. You know, growing up, I remember wanting very much to have an intimate relationship with my parents. It was much easier with my mother because my mom was just more open and had those characteristic feminine qualities of wanting to touch me and hold me, would listen to my complaints and my pains. I was always amazed that my mother knew I was sick before I ever had any idea I was sick. You know, she would just kind of naturally and intuitively care for me. I see that in my wife, where something will happen with me or the kids, and she just immediately switches to the mode of service. And at times I'm like, wow, I want to do that, but I don't seem to do it as intuitively and naturally. So my relationship with my mother was a bit easier. I could talk with her. I could express my emotions with her. I had a harder time with my dad. My dad was kind of a World War II vet. There was kind of a distance between us. A good bit of the respect I had was, frankly, fear. My dad got angry, and I didn't want anything to do with my dad being angry. But upon looking back, I began to recognize only years later, maybe even when I had my own kids, that there were things that I would do that really were motivated by wanting to have a more intimate relationship with my parents. I remember in 1968, I could name all of the political candidates running for president on the Democratic and Republican side. So I don't know, as in third grade, you know, and I remember being very excited that Robert Kennedy had decided to run for the presidency, and I remember him being assassinated, the shock of that event. But looking back on all of that, I don't think I was terribly interested in the candidates. My dad was interested in what was happening in the country. My dad would watch the news, and he would talk about things. So in a sense, I would go to the dinner table wanting to make a contribution to a political discussion because, quite frankly, I wanted to be close to my dad. I wanted to care about the things that he cared about, right? As I grew a little bit older, I realized that there were friends in my neighborhood, people I went to school with, people I played ball with, developing relationships with them, kind of sharing, you know, kind of sharing our lives together. I think back to some of the baseball that I played, and what's interesting is I don't necessarily think about the big hits I got. Sometimes I think about the errors I made. But more than anything, I think about the pleasure I had of playing on a team and having teammates. And guys in my neighborhood, gosh, I had a friend named Fred Gomez. I lived in a largely Mexican-American, Hispanic neighborhood. Fred was, we met in first grade. We didn't finish our math, and were made to stay over. So we were trying to find some comfort. But Fred became a very close friend, a person I probably saw almost every day until I got married, and he was in my wedding party. Well, then there reached a point of my life where I became interested in the opposite sex. And I began to think, wow, wouldn't it be great to have a relationship with one of these pretty girls who are amazing. You know, they look amazing and they smell amazing and they have these qualities and these characteristics. And I began to later think, wow, my parents were married. My siblings have been married. What would it be like to have a marriage relationship? You know, a person you could put your trust in, somebody who was there for you. These ideas of in richer or poorer, in sickness or in health, this commitment of marriage. And looking back on all of this, and then the event of having my own children, I realize that the most important reality in my life are the relationships that I have, and how very easy it is to make mistakes in life where, you know, maybe I work too much and ignore the kind of relationships that are in my life, or to, you know, to do various other types of things. But the question that I want to raise here is, why do we care so much about relationships? Why is it that to be loved, to give love and to receive love, you know, there are some kinds of relationships that are not healthy, right? I remember a girl I met in high school, you know, I liked her, but she wanted nothing to do with me. Well, that doesn't work. It can't be a one-way type of loving relationship. When I met my wife, Joan, I realized, wow, there is this giving, there is this sharing and caring that is involved in this. Or being obsessive, where you have kind of a narcissistic love, where it's all about you, and I use people, right? Instead of this give and sharing type of thing. Well, this now comes to the best explanation question. Why do we care about loving relationships? Why do we care so much about these interpersonal relationships? And I thought Greg Gansel made a very powerful point. It made me stop and think a little bit. He said, you know, you might meet somebody and you want to share the gospel with them. And you say to them, you know, you're a sinner and you need to repent of your sin and you need to find forgiveness in Jesus Christ. And Gansel said, you know, there are people who really don't have a clear understanding of their own sinfulness. They're kind of oblivious to it. They don't kind of relate to that. But Gansel said that virtually everybody can relate to a relationship. Virtually everybody knows what it means to be part of a community, part of a caring group. I mean, we look for that in our churches. We look for that in our families, right? We look for that in our personal relationships. How do we best explain that? What is the drive for that? Now, I want to introduce two competing worldviews to Christianity, and I actually want to develop even some other worldviews. You know, the first worldview is theism. The first worldview is this idea that there is one God who is personal, and who is loving. He has a will and a mind. Well, that's theism. That's monotheism. And we begin to see the varieties of monotheism, first of all in Judaism, then in Christianity. Then Islam becomes quite a competing monotheistic religious option, right? But there are other worldview options. Let's look to the East. I recently published my book, God Among Sages, where I looked very carefully at Hinduism and Buddhism and Confucianism. The tendency when you go to the Eastern religions is God becomes something less than personal. I don't know if the Buddha believed in God. He didn't talk much about God. God doesn't seem to play a central place in primitive Buddhism, early Buddhism. you know, it gets a bit more complicated with Mahayana Buddhism. But even in Hinduism, there are parts of Hinduism, not all of Hinduism, but there are parts of Hinduism where God seems less than personal. Although one of the things I discovered in writing this book is that most Hindus worship Krishna. They have a bhakti, a devotional relationship. So even they want that kind of relationship. So some religions can be less than personal, less than relational. Now let's place one more worldview option on the table, and that's secularism. That's naturalism. That's atheism, where there's no God. The physical universe is just kind of a brute reality. There's no life after death. And then the question becomes, why are relationships so important in that worldview? And how are relationships explained in that worldview? So let me kind of make some kind of frame the issue. If these meaningful relationships are so very important, and again, I want to bring you back to this point. I don't want you to miss it. I don't want you to skip over it. Most of the time when we get a little bit older in life, we begin to realize that making money and some of the other things in life are not nearly as important as the intimacy of our relationships. Now, I don't want to miss that. I don't want to give a misnomer. For a lot of us, we work hard because we want to provide a living for our family. So it's easy to become a workaholic for good reasons. You know, I want my family to have a nice home. I want my kids to have a good education. I want to provide, right, for my family. But it's easy to kind of get mixed up, and maybe later in life we start looking back and say, wow, where am I in life? Am I really close to the people that I care about? Part of the tension, of course, is that personal relationships are complex. They're difficult. The relationship that I had with my parents was quite challenging. I've had sibling relationships that have been challenging. I'm sure they look at me and say, Ken is quite challenging to deal with. But in a worldview of Eastern mysticism, that personal relationship may be absent or unexplained. If God is less than personal, then why do we care so much about the personal? If Eastern mystical religion doesn't seem to have an explanation for the relational, why do we care so deeply about the relational? With the atheists, where's the relationship? I like to mention that when I drive to work, I come on the 10 freeway, and I can't miss Forest Lawn. It's right there. It's right before your face, basically telling you you're going to die.
Hopefully your appointment is not very soon.
Yeah, it might be a decade or two or three ahead of you, but the idea is all of my relationships will end in death if atheism is true. And so relationships, personhood, they seem to be the product of blind, mechanistic, accidental processes, and there's no kind of ultimate fulfillment of them. All that you are ends in death. The plug is pulled, and consciousness and relationships and personhood comes to a direct end. I mean, that's a pretty painful. It kind of moves you existentially to think that, wow, this is the end, and you know there is no other. Now, of course, some of the atheists, people like Jean-Paul Sartre, the French atheist, the existentialist, he said, you know, you have to face that. You have to rise above it. You have to face the forlornness of that worldview and somehow create your own destiny. Or the 19th century atheist Friedrich Nietzsche says that you need to be the Übermensch, the overman who takes that on and responds to it. Well, I think some deep philosophical reflection might lead you to be filled with angst. Now, with monotheism, right?
Now, before we move on, the naturalist does try to explain the survival benefit, for instance, of individuals in a population working together or trying to develop relationships because of the survival benefit that one is gained through. So they do offer some kind of explanation for why we want to develop relationships.
But that's exactly right. But I would immediately add that survival relationships is very different than having a meaningful personal life.
The sacrificial component that is part of what you're speaking of that is harder for them to explain. Why am I willing to, there's a word that goes along with it, but to sacrifice what's good for me.
Altruism
is the word I was trying to think of.
And I would add that immediately the question is, but all of that's going to end. All of that striving, all of that survivability, there seems to be more to it than just the physical survival. We want these relationships to be caring and to be generous and to be supportive. And it's bleak. It seems like there really isn't much of, there's no future if you think of the extinction of human beings and the end. You know, I like to fast forward ahead and talk about entropy. You know, there's no heat, there's no light, no work gets done, right? Mm-hmm. Now, let's entertain this issue of Christianity, of theism. Obviously, Jews, Christians, and Muslims believe that God is personal. They believe that that God is capable of loving, that he created human beings. Jews and Christians both believe that God made human beings in their image. Muslims do not believe that. Islam does not believe that God, Allah, created human beings in his image, because that would violate a theological principle that is deeply important in Islam, that God has, you can't place a creature too close to the nature of God, that there is this otherness of Allah, so much so that critics of Islam would say that Allah seems to be impersonal, unknowable, that you don't have the kind of intimacy of the relationship with God. Now, Muslims, of course, deny that. They say in the Quran that one of the 99 names for God is the loving. And I'm not an expert on Arabic by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not an expert, Joe, on English, to be perfectly candid. But from what I know about the Arabic writing of the loving, it isn't a narcissistic where Allah looks in the mirror and admires himself. It is this giving, this generous nature. Mm-hmm. Now, here I think I would like to introduce Christianity, because I've had some interesting experiences talking with Muslims and with Jews, and raising this question of, if Allah or Yahweh, if they're single solitary beings and persons, so in traditional Judaism and Islam, God is one being and one individual person. There's no plurality of personhood in the traditional understanding of Yahweh, right? There's no diversity of persons within the one nature of Allah. And in fact, Jews and Christians have always been very critical of Christianity for the idea that they would worship Jesus. And they believe that there is a third person called the Holy Spirit. So Jews and Christians have always been critical of Christianity. They think Christianity verges toward or leans toward polytheism, because you have these diversity of persons within the one nature. Of course, a question that I have asked, and I've probably mentioned this more than once on the podcast, I remember Hugh Ross and I sitting down with two Jewish fellows. One was a secular Jew. One was kind of a religious Jew. I don't know whether, I don't think he was Orthodox, but you know, he may have been Reform or conservative. Judaism has its own denominations, and most of them are quite liberal. And I don't mean that politically. I mean that theologically. But Hugh and I were sitting down, and you know, we were talking with him. And one of the guys said, "I want to hear your point of view. I don't want to die and go to hell and never, you know, understand this message of Christianity." So Hugh and I took kind of time out of our busy schedule to talk with him. And to be quite frankly, it was difficult to kind of get a word in edgewise. They were very loquacious. And, you know, Hugh and I were kind of just trying to jump in various places. But I remember we had about a 90-minute conversation. Maybe it was 2 hours. I said to them at the end, I said, you know, we want to leave something with you, and we want you to leave something with us so that we can kind of think about these issues. And I said to them, I have a question for you, a theological question. I said, if you believe in traditional Judaism, where God is one being, one person, who did Yahweh love in eternity before he created the angels, before he created human beings? And believe me, these guys are very talkative. Hugh and I, again, struggled to get a word in. They said nothing for about 90 seconds. And one of them said, nobody has ever asked me that before. They had no response. You know, and there are questions, even in the Old Testament, when God is spoken of in the plural, who's he talking to? Who's he talking about? Is this kind of a royal kind of plurality? From what I understanding, my understanding of Hebrew is that doesn't exist in Hebrew. Now, Dennis Prager, who is a Jewish talk show host that I have been on his program here in Southern California, and he has a program that goes across the country. I remember Dennis saying, well, he was talking to the angels, but there is a point in which the angels are created. What about before? I said the same thing to a couple Muslims that I had kind of informal debates with online. And they were Islamic apologists, and we went back and forth, and they thought, both of them initially, it was kind of parallel experiences with them. They thought, man, you're not a very smart Christian. And they kind of insulted me for a while. But I kept pushing them. I said, you know, let me quote your holy book, the Quran. You say two things that I think are not consistent. You say on one hand that Allah is the loving, and yet you say on the other hand that Allah is dependent upon nothing. And I said, so who did Allah love in eternity before he created angels and human beings? And they had a hard time with it. They wanted to say the angels. I said, yeah, but remember, there's something before the angels. And they want to say, well, he loves himself. But I said, but from what I understand about the Arabic is that's not just looking in the mirror, you know, glowing at yourself. And I said, it seems like what you have is Allah is alone in eternity. He has no one to love. And then the question is, does he need to create in order to fulfill himself, to fulfill his loving self? And I said, you seem to have a convoluted system. On one hand, you want to have a loving God, but he has no one to love. But you also want to have an independent God, and yet he needs to create it in order to get that love. And amazingly, both of them being, you know, cerebral guys, both of them being, you know, they like to mix it up intellectually. Both of them said to me, I apologize. I don't know who Allah loved in eternity. I said, you know what? That's okay. Why don't you go ask one of your imams? ask one of your teachers. Go, you know what? These are questions we're asking. And they both apologized to me, which I thought was pretty cool. Now let me introduce to you the Trinity. The Trinity is unique. The Trinity sets Christianity apart from Judaism and from Islam and from all other religious and non-religious systems. You know, most of the Christians, I want to be a little more careful in my words. It seems that for a lot of Christians, the Trinity is kind of an arcane riddle. They know, that is, Christians know that it's important and they need to believe it in order to be orthodox. But it doesn't seem to make a big difference in their life. And they're not quite sure. Well, it's hard to understand, and I don't know how practical it is, but I know I need to believe it or I'll be kicked out of the faith. Right. But I would tell you that the Trinity is the most important and most practical Christian doctrine of all, because what it tells us is that at the core of reality, at the fundamental nature of what's real and true, there is a relational God. And so relationships and love stand at the very foundation of reality. And the Trinity, you know, I'm going to use an analogy here. Sometimes we feel a little uncomfortable about using analogies, and I understand that. Some analogies can break down very quickly. You know, the analogy of water, you know, you've got it in ice and liquid and steam.
Three different states,
and you know, some of these other analogies, they tend toward modalism, you know, where God simply changes modes or manifestations, or polytheism. And I can appreciate that. Theologically, the Trinity isn't always easy to kind of carefully define and grasp. But what I like to say is, let's use an analogy. Remember, analogies are intended to try to point at something. They're intended to kind of convey an idea, but it isn't locked down. It isn't a perfect, total explanation. Well, I think an analogy of the Trinity is that God is like a family. God is like a family. The Father has eternally loved the Son in the Holy Spirit. And so when John says in 1 John that God is love, he doesn't say, and I know enough Greek, New Testament Greek to know, he doesn't say God is loving. He says God is love. God is love. Well, how can God be love? I don't think Yahweh, with all deep respect for the Jewish understanding of God, because my Messiah is the Jewish Messiah, after all. Judaism and Christianity have a unique, distinct relationship. But Yahweh and Allah don't seem to be intrinsically loving. Why? No relationships.
Mm. Good point.
No relationships. Whereas the Trinity, now let me read you a quotation. There is a book that I read a couple years ago. I recommended it to Dave. It's a book by Michael Reeves, Delighting in the Trinity. And again, I want to return to this idea that the Trinity is not some arcane riddle. It's not some difficult idea. It really gets at the most meaningful thing in life. The most meaningful thing in life. I suspect that when I get ready to die, I want to hold my wife's hand. I'll want to look into the eyes of my children. I hope some of my friends will come and want to say goodbye to me and pray for me. A few years ago, I had a life-threatening illness, and I thought, you know what? I think maybe I have to get prepared for this. And, you know, life became a lot more simple. It was this woman that I've been married to and the kids I had and the people who cared about me and prayed for me. Here is a quotation from Michael Reeves. He introduces us to a Christian scholar. He says, sometime in the 1150s, a young Scot named Richard entered the Abbey of St. Victor, just outside the walls of Paris on the bank of the Seine, which is the river there in France. There he dedicated himself to contemplating God and was soon known as one of the most influential authors of his day. Richard argued that if God were just one person, he could not be intrinsically loving, since for all eternity before creation, he would have had no one to love, nobody to love. If there were two persons, he went on, God might be loving, but in an excluding, ungenerous way. After all, when two persons love each other, they can be so infatuated with each other that they simply ignore everyone else. And a God like that would be far from good news. But when the love between two persons is healthy, is happy, healthy, and secure, they rejoice to share it. Just so it is with God, said Richard. Being perfectly loving from all eternity, the Father and the Son have delighted to share their love and joy with it, with and through the Spirit. It is not then that God becomes sharing, being triune. God is a sharing God, a God who loves to include. Indeed, that is why God will go on to create. His love is not for keeping, but for spreading. Now, you know, I want to bring us back. I know our time is getting late here. Try to keep these podcasts to a manageable number of minutes. But I don't want to leave without, again, sharing the idea that Christianity says, uniquely Christianity, not Judaism, not Islam, but uniquely Christianity says that at the core of reality, the ultimate real, the ultimate truth is not only a personal God, but a loving, giving, sharing God. At the foundation of reality is a God who is analogously like a family. And, you know, I would share in my own life that I remember when my wife and I were just married. We were married a few years, and my wife shared with me one day, she said, I want to have a baby. And I could tell by the tone of her voice and by her insistence, she was serious about this, because I kept telling her, well, you know what, let's wait until I get through school, you know, until I get a really good job, and, you know, then we can have a family. And, you know, and she said, I want to have a baby. And I realized, wow, I have to deal with my wife's desire here. And so I was always thinking to myself, you know what, we're going to have this baby and she'll take care of the kid and, you know, she won't care about me and, you know, I'll become third in line and all of this kind of thing. And then we had our daughter, Sarah, and my life was changed forever. What happened was that it's like our daughter being born showed my wife and I ways of love that we had never seen before, and how easy it was to sacrificially give. And, you know, I had this person in my life, this young mind, this loving person, you know, our daughter.
And you were delighting in the Trinity.
I was delighting. Boy, I thought to myself, you know, I knew enough theology to think, you know, maybe in a finite, limited way, maybe I feel the way the Father feels about his own Son. Mm-hmm. And what was funny is, rather than taking away love, rather than introducing selfishness, I began to see kind of this magicalness of the family. And that there was a loving and a fulfilling that I had never seen before. And being a father became, you know, I began saying things like, you know, the books I write or the lectures that I give or, you know, whatever I accomplish in my career, I know isn't nearly as important as this relationship that I have with my family. And I meant it sincerely. And then, of course, we had another child. We had another daughter, Jacqueline. And what I began to realize is that you could add children. And they took part in that family relationship. It's as if the threeness, you can add to the three with the daughter, Jacqueline, and then later my little boy, Michael, came along. And it can add to the three, but the three is the magic number.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the threeness, with the two-ness, I think my wife and I remember when we first met, we were kind of head over heels with each other, kind of oblivious to other people. But when our little daughter Sarah came along, it was like, we're in. You know, we're devoted.
Now just think, if you had waited until you were financially successful and so on.
When does that come,
Dave? You'd still be waiting, and you wouldn't have had any children.
That's right. That's exactly right. You wonder, I remember Vern Poitras being on our show, the theologian from Westminster. He says that the illusion of life is that, you know, we have control over our life. We're the master of our own fate. Quite frankly, no one has control over their finances. Mm-hmm. No one has mastery over their life. Life is kind of lived with faith in the future, if you will. But my point here, and I'll close with this, we're made in the image of God. And as Dave would say, that means that in some sense, we're in God's category. It doesn't mean that we're infinite. It doesn't mean we're internal. It doesn't mean that we become ontological deities. But it does mean that God relates to us, and especially in redemption, we have the life of God that is within us.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Trinity, while often seen as, you know, difficult, or I just don't know how to practically apply it, what I want to tell people is that maybe what we can say to the non-Christian friends we have, maybe our neighbors, maybe some of our family members, you know, I have family members that are not Christian, or people that we work with, maybe what we can say to them is, you know, in my life, relationships are the most important thing. And having a loving, giving, sharing, caring relationship is something that I think is going to be on my mind and my lips at my last breath. But Christianity says that that is the very ultimate nature of reality. It's not true in atheism. Mm-hmm. And it's not true in Buddhism and Hinduism, and it's not best explained either in Judaism or in Islam.
You know, just to amen what you're saying about the joy that you get out of the relationship, especially when you have children and all of that. But as a scientist, I get a lot of joy out of discovery, out of, making up some new, doing some new research or doing something that, but there isn't nearly the joy that there is in being able to share that with someone else.
Yeah.
If you don't have that personal relationship with at least someone else, I always make a joke out of the fact that I write a paper and it gets published, and you wonder whether anybody ever reads it.
Yeah.
You know?
Goes into that black hole.
That's right. So even in that area of our lives, in my case, this research, the joy comes out of having the opportunity to share that with others.
Dave, I know you're a teacher, and so am I. I think one of the things I find most fulfilling out of teaching is that aspect of being able to share.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember thinking one day there was some angle of the incarnation, and I couldn't wait to share that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say, you know, let's consider this.
Mm-hmm.
Let me also make one more point here, Joe, and I'll turn it over to you. I think it's also important for us to then connect it to the doctrine of the incarnation. Jesus is both God and man, and he has come to this planet, and he has lived a perfect life, made a sacrifice of his death on the cross to take away our sins. And so the way we need to think of Jesus, I think, is that He reconciles all of the problems that exist between God and man. Because he's God and man, he's able to solve those problems of sin with his sacrifice. He's able to illustrate his love. And when we look at Jesus, this is the Father's gift. I think it is Irenaeus. I need to go back and check, but I think it's the church father Irenaeus who used an analogy. He said the Son and the Spirit are the Father's two hands. The Father acts through the Son and the Spirit. And that's the way he loves us. That's the way he relates to us. And again, these are analogies, right? These are to illustrate these kinds of things. But what we see is the coming of the incarnation, that Jesus is born under the reign of Caesar Augustus. Advent, Christmas, Jesus coming into the world. But then there's Pentecost, the coming of the Holy Spirit, right? And so the Trinity is a powerful truth because it tells us that the ultimate nature of reality is a relational person, not just a single solitary person, but a interpersonal God, a generous God, a giving God, and that is why we seek out these kinds of things. And I think that provides a certain level of explanation that these other worldviews, I think, have to wrestle to try to be able to explain. In an atheist world, I think relationships are ultimately unexplained, other than some of the physiological evolutionary elements that Dave alluded to earlier. I don't think there's any ultimate explanation for persons and relationship. And in our next program, I hope to pick this up and focus on a few other issues of reasoning to the best explanation, or what I call best explanation apologetics.
All right. Terrific. We will look forward to that. You mentioned the book Delighting in the Trinity by Michael Reeves. I think we did a podcast or two on that topic. It may have been the Straight Thinking podcast.
I think that's right.
Back then, if people do a search on our website, they can find that. So just search by that topic, and I'm sure you'll be able to find it there. Make sure you pick up a copy or two of Ken's book, God Among Sages, if you have not done so already. Get two copies of that one, as we've been mentioning on recent podcasts. You will not be disappointed. It is an excellent book, so we highly recommend that. All right, for Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthlypartners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.